動でお風呂を沸かします。お風呂の栓は来ましたか？自動でお風呂を沸かします。
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter Murray, Anna Tashinsky, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that everyone in the French town of Evian is allowed unlimited free Evian.
Are they allowed it from, like, do they have to go up and put their mouth to the spring? Well, I don't know how it comes out.
It does come through the taps, right?
No. Andy's closest, but he is wrong. So this is the town of Evian des Bains, on the banks of the Lake Geneva, and it's in France. And they have this special spring of water. Yeah. And this is where we get the Evian today. But the people of the town can go to the spring. It has a special sort of spout. And you can go and get unlimited Evian from there. You don't have to go with your mouth on the spout. When I went there...
Because that ruins the spout forever. It ruins the entire company's operations, actually. Millions of people. Yeah,
absolutely. So I went there recently on my holidays because you guys have had some guests on the last few weeks.
Yep.
I was going from a ski resort to Geneva, where our flight was going from, and saw that Evian was, I won't say on the way, we had to take quite a long diversion, but I said to my wife, why don't we go to this place, Evian, because it's kind of an interesting place that I've heard of. Baby was sick, but it was fine.
Drank some bad water or something.
But we went there, and I drank some of the Evian water with my cupped hand. So I allowed it to go into my cupped hand, and I drank it. But just as we're leaving, actually, there was a guy who turned up in his car, opened his boot, and he must have had about 50 glass bottles where he went to the spring, and he filled up all of his bottles, so he had as much Evian as he could drink. And that apparently is a common thing that the people of Evian do.
You're so lucky that... you got there before him, rather than just... All you want... mate, I'm just trying to fill up my two cupped hands here. No, sorry, I've only got 47 bottles to go. What I'm imagining is like a municipal water... not a water cooler, you know, a thing like in a school gym where you put your mouth to it.
Yeah, it's like, not press like the button, quite like
press the button and it squirts up a bit, but not very much.
No, it's not that. It's something where it is always flowing out.
Oh, nice.
So it is kind of a mosaic of a nice sort of... like flowers and stuff like that, and then there's a little bowl underneath made of stone, and the water just keeps going into the bowl and then drains away, presumably to the Evian factory, where it then goes into your bottles. No, I don't know about
if you're, a rival company, could you just go and bottle your own bottles?
Brilliant.
You could, but I imagine it's probably not efficient.
Probably the cost is not the water, it's the bottling factory.
If you're Buxton Springs, say, and your entire factory is in Buxton in Derbyshire, probably it's not worth it to drive all the way down to Geneva.
Free water. I mean, you could just get it out of the tap if you were trying to get more like water.
Which some bottle companies did, didn't they? Dasani, I think, famously
Dasani, which
did
was
that.
Coke owned, and it just turned out to be tap water that they'd sort of run that water under the tap. I didn't know how they'd done it, but they basically like.
I think that's slightly misleading, but if it was what it still is now, which is that it's tap water, as is more than 2/3 of bottled water in America, lots of it here. Basically, it's filtered tap water, so they've taken tap water and filtered it. But the great thing about these big soft drinks companies is they're already filtering the water to put in their Fanta and their Coke or whatever. So they've got this big water filtration system set up. All they need to do is turn the tap on a bit more. So yeah,
that's clever.
Yeah. But what do they drink then in Evian through the tap? Mm. Is it the same source of water coming through? Or is
what
it
a good question. So no, because they will have, and I don't know this for sure, but they must have reservoirs where the water comes from, because this is just a small spring and certainly wouldn't be enough to fill what is an averagely sized French town.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I heard though that they only take about 10% of the Evian water to turn into Evian from this spring.
I can believe that.
And it filters down through the rock, and then it takes about 15 years, and it goes into an underground aquifer. And then once the aquifer is full, the water gets forced up back up to the surface.
Okay.
And then it emerges at that spring. And that whole thing takes 15 years to do, I believe.
That's what they say on their website. 15 years is the number.
That's where I got it from.
Yeah.
Why would they lie about that? It's actually 19 years, but 15 is such a round number.
There is an interesting thing on the website which talks about the history. I don't know if you saw this. They said that 1789 was a very important year in Evian water history. And seeing as they were in France, it feels like 1789 probably was quite a important year.
I thought that.
Pretty much for everyone, because actually their water source was discovered by a French nobleman.
Right.
Do you feel like probably had other things on his mind?
That was the last thing he ever did, wasn't it?
I have looked for the Marquis de Lessert, who I'm sure was not top of the list when the revolution came, but I searched his name. Yeah. There's no other, he doesn't crop up anywhere else.
No, he doesn't. I think there is some suggestion that a bit of this origin story might not be 100% true, but right. it was on this guy's land in Evian, yeah. And supposedly this nobleman had kidney stones or something, yeah. Drank some of this water, and his kidney stones disappeared, and he was like, this is great stuff, right. And then the guy who owned the land started to sell the water.
Yeah. It's not if it was a perfect origin story, like the one they always make up, it would be, he was out for a walk one day, he fell over, some of the water fell into his mouth, and then he felt his kidney stones clearing up, so weird. Yeah.
Bottled water, the idea comes from the fact that it was good for your health, doesn't it? It was a medicine, yeah. For ages. That's the reason we drink it today, really, is because of all these bain places or bath places, like Bath or Leamington or Buxton. And in the 19th century, in your Jane Austen...
Sorry, just Bath is named after Bath. Is that like having a bath? It would be so weird if we said, I'm just going to go and have a quick Leamington. Yeah. Have you given the baby his Leamington tonight?
Although we should make clear for the email writers that we do know that baths are not named after the place Bath.
I didn't know that. And I don't mind getting an email about it. I'm pleased to have someone now. It's redundant. Are they not? That's a coincidence.
Other way around.
It's going to be the other way around, isn't it?
What?
you work on that logic for a moment.
No, it could have been where someone had the first bath.
It could have been.
A Roman walking by, tripped, fell into the hot water, loved it.
A loofah landed on his head.
And a duck floated by. And he squeezed it and went, whack. This is amazing.
Anyway, the way that bottling began, actually, was people used to go somewhere like Bath and they'd take the waters for their health, like in Jane Austen. Yeah. You'd drink the waters, you'd bathe in the waters, you'd get rid of your whatever palsy you had or spots or whatever. But some people were too busy or too poor to be able to afford this constant water treatments and travelling to these spa towns. So they subscribed instead, much like you might subscribe to, I don't know, HelloFresh or...
Right. We're off the clock, Anna. You don't have to do this. Yeah.
They subscribed to water deliveries, which would be bottled up and sent to them for their health.
And those are the original bottles.
That's the original bottled water.
That's very cool. So it was a kind of spa destination, Evian, as well. And this was before they were bottling it. This is 1806. They had a thermal spa that opened. The bottling happened in 1826.
Yeah.
But you would think then that as a result, this is just like, you'd go there, it'd be this majestical, like kind of mindfulness place and really nice. But we have an account of what it was like from someone traveling through there in the 1810s, roughly. And that was Percy Shelley and Mary Shelley. He said, the appearance of the inhabitants is more wretched, diseased, and poor than I ever recollect to have seen.
Wow.
So not a great TripAdvisor review there.
Not a good advert for the health-giving waters.
It does appear in Frankenstein as well, by the way, Evian.
He goes on his honeymoon there, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, Dr. Frankenstein?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
He goes to Evian, yeah. So, Mary Shelley literally puts the town into the book.
Phil Collins has a house on the banks of Lake Geneva.
Get out.
Does he?
What? Is that surprising?
I'm happier I know it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I just looked up people who live near Lake Geneva. It's quite posh, isn't it, that area? It's got nice stuff
it's quite
there.
Quite posh, yeah. It became posh after they found the water, really. They built massive hotels there and a casino.
Oh, yeah.
The casino's interesting because after World War II and Hitler killed himself, there were rumours that Hitler was still alive. And there was a rumour that he was working as a croupier in Evian in the big casino.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Loads of people went down there trying to find Hitler. And they were like, oh, no, it's just a guy who looks like Hitler.
Wow. How long were you there for, by the way? Were you just...
Just until the baby started crying, so about 45 minutes.
Oh, okay, so just to have it.
Yeah, purely. we needed somewhere to go for lunch, so we just went there.
Okay. Not long enough to find Hitler.
No, we didn't see Hitler.
And are you guys a fan of Evian? Drink it at home?
Yeah, I drink Evian.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyone else in your household drink Evian?
Yeah, everyone in my house drinks Evian, yeah.
Who are the members of your household again?
Well, it's myself and my wife.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And my daughter.
Yeah.
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 Anyone else?
Well, no, humans.
Look, we've got to come out and say this. For the record, James has got a cat. And sometimes his cat drinks Evian.
And when we say
only,
sometimes...
Only when she's thirsty.
Every single day. James gives his cat Evian.
I have to say, before we started, these guys already knew this. And I do think of all the things in my life, this is the only thing that really can spoil my man of the people.
This is your meow to moment, isn't it?
Brilliant.
Hey.
Brilliant.
And I kind of want you to keep hold of it, because isn't it because of
it's
something
your fault.
I told you?
It's yeah, Anna's it's fault. And just, dear listener, this is what happened. Anna told me that cats have special taste buds on their tongues that can taste water. And so for us, water doesn't taste of anything. Mm-hmm. But for cats, it's really important and they can taste the difference. And London water is disgusting.
True.
And we happen to have quite a lot of Evian in the house because I'd stockpiled a load for COVID.
Yep.
And I just started giving it to my cat and she liked it and she still likes
You've
it.
Changed since you left Bolton, James.
We
have
live
changed.
By our facts. I think the listeners would appreciate that we live and we die and our cats live and die by our facts. And that's fair enough. And it's true. Cats can taste water, whereas we can't. But then there's this big question over, given that water tastes of nothing, how do we know we're drinking water and not some poisonous substance all the time?
Oh. Well, you can't.
That's
well,
interesting.
Because it doesn't taste, because it's...
But there are some tasteless things, like arsenic doesn't taste of anything, does
Indeed.
It?
Indeed.
But you can't, like, if I...
if I give you a pint of arsenic, you wouldn't necessarily know it was not water.
No, really? That's true, but I would just think the odds are you struggle to get hold of a pint of arsenic. You'd have to I'd have to have really annoyed you.
And keep going.
He's a very resourceful man. And he's,
no, I just sort of think it's probably going to be water. It's probably, and I've been right every time so far. I don't like to brag.
You only have to be wrong once.
No, that's true. I'll keep spinning that
but
wheel.
There is a reason you haven't been wrong, which is that you can tell that it's water. And they've only just found this. Mm. And it's that it doesn't taste sour, but it registers on our sour taste buds. And this is related to a fact that a guest shared, actually. One of those other guests we had in when we kicked James off the show, I think. Yeah. Basically, when you drink water, it washes away your saliva. And then our mouths, in the process of replacing saliva, produce protons. And Steve Mould, when he came on, his fact was protons taste sour.
Oh, yeah.
So it triggers our sour taste buds. Yeah. It is mad how much bottled water we drink now. I had no idea how much people are drinking bottled water, and I don't get it. So obviously in developing countries, it's really important because you can't get, in a lot of countries, you can't get clean tap water.
Can't
but that
get
is,
tasty water in London, of course.
You can't get delicious water in London. same problem. But it's not developing countries.
I'm not helping here.
You're fast tracking to cancellation. It's not developing countries that are consuming it all. So in Singapore, how many litres do you reckon per person per annum?
Per annum?
Oh
my God.
That's how many? I mean, half a litre a day. A litre a day, 300 litres. 300 litres per person per annum of tap water.
1,129 litres
can
per person.
3 litres of water a day.
Bottled and bottled.
3 litres of bottled water per person per day. That's
insane.
Lot.
Because Frankens. There's going to be some outliers, aren't there? There's going to be some people who don't have any of that.
Yeah. Australia is the second worst offender. Australians are drinking 504 litres of bottled water a person a
year. Get out.
Isn't that insane?
It's bananas.
That's really hot.
The water's good. Yeah, but the water's good.
The tap water's fine.
I don't know.
There are a lot of cats in Australia. Yeah, just to say.
We're by the beach. You can't drink the salt water. You need to have a good
No
old...
one is proposing you drink salt water. There is such a gap in your logic
no, there's
between
not.
The bottled water and the sea.
No, the logic is you're down by the sea for a lot of the day where you cannot get access to
fill
tap
bottle,
water.
Fill up a bottle and take it down.
Oh, yeah.
I do think that's that argument has persuaded me, not that it's right, but that's probably why it is. Mm. It's convenient, isn't it? People are out.
Yeah.
They've forgotten their bottle.
Exactly.
Remember your bottle, Australians.
Is everyone at the beach always in Australia? I know that's the myth that we read, but like, I don't believe
they all do live
done.
Next to the beach, though, don't they? I mean, no one lives in the middle.
Where you'd also need bottled water.
I found a thing about water pipes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
This was because I was looking up, you know, tap water and how it, you know, just how it works and what the pipes are like, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Anyway, this is from a website called Best Life Online.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh,
yeah. And the headline is 8 Surprising Places You're Letting Snakes into Your Home.
I'd be surprised living in central London if they're getting in anywhere.
Yeah, and actually, the terrible thing about this article was I wasn't especially surprised by any of the places.
Well, what toilet? They
toilet.
Come up through your toilet.
Yeah. Toilet, water pipes,
window,
plumbing gaps. Didn't have window.
Cat, no. Cat door.
No, cat, that's good. That's much. I would be a bit surprised by that because you're expecting the cat, aren't you? showers, cracks in the foundation, basement access points, and the only one I find mildly surprising, shoes you might have left outside.
Yeah, that fair makes
enough.
Sense.
Come home, take off your shoes outside, you know.
What would be a surprising entry, though?
out of your computer tower. Like just spiraling out of
computer tower. I just do my work on my computer in my office in my house. Do you go all the way to your computer tower
this
to send
is where
emails?
I'm out of touch. I have a tower, a medieval fortification that I do my computer work
in. It's annoying because you can't get Wi-Fi in there, but you still go over there.
You can get a bit if you stand near one of the arrow slits. You get a tiny bit, but it's not much.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that there's a mangrove forest in Indonesia that's actually a woman grove.
Brilliant. Riddle roundabout.
Yeah, it's not really a fact that you can tell your friends, is it, without me explaining it a bit further. But it's really cool. So this is in Papua, and it's a forest called Hutan Perempuan, and it's a forest where only women are allowed to go. The oldest women who go there say it's been happening for as long as they can remember, and their grandmothers did it. And mangroves are basically forests that are underwater, partly. So
No, sorry.
That's a bad description. I backtrack.
Mangroves are trees. The mangrove, there are about a few dozen species of mangrove tree, and they're the only trees which can grow in salt water. They're amazing things for all sorts of reasons.
You tend to get them in brackish areas where it's like right on the coast, so it's where the salt water hits the fresh
all
water.
Along the shoreline. Yeah. You get these great
and
mangrove
where it's basically they exist between high and low tides, so they spend a lot of their life in water and a lot of their life out of water, and it's very swampy and gross in a mangrove. But these swampy, it's gross if you don't like swampy, but these women like it. Because they get to gossip, essentially. So these are specifically people from the Engros and Tobati tribes on the Indonesian side of Papua Island. And they wade in, they collect these shellfish from the mud, they sell them at market. You have to go in naked, which is kind of the reason why men aren't allowed, because then they see the ladies naked. And they essentially use it as a way to swap stories, do some female bonding, bitch about the men, pass down a lot of ancient wisdom. It's just a really great women-only place.
It's like gossiping, slagging off the men. Occasionally a bit of ancient wisdom if
time allows. I like those because I subscribe to one of those gossip magazines, but then on the last page there's always a little bit of ancient wisdom.
But they also, they're encouraged to just yell out whatever their inner voice is. So just random statements that no one will understand.
Oh, really?
But it's like, yeah, you get it out. You do that. That's fine. Yeah.
Oh, that's clever.
The inner voice yell. Yeah.
I read that men are allowed in the forest, but only when there are no women there. Is that right?
That is correct. So there are times that men are allowed in to collect wood, but they've got to make sure that there are no ladies in there.
Question. It feels to me like it would be quite hard to work out when there are no ladies in a forest, as in forests are big. Is there like one of those in-out stickers or labels where you just slide it over?
No, you just got to listen to the gossiping that's going on, which is basically what they say. That's it, so they can just talk and talk. So if you can't hear any ladies, they're probably not there because they use it as their time literally to just
is anyone
have
gossiping
great
or quoting Marcus Aurelius? And then no. Yeah. And if you do enter as a man when you're not allowed to, you are taken to tribal court and you have to pay a fine in polished stones.
Really?
I heard. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. So they take their kolkol, it's called. It's like their boat. They have a sort of group of them that go out with a singular boat and they make a pact not to leave each other. And then they go clam hunting, fish hunting as well. And big problems in modern day mangrove, woman grove situations is the fact that people like Evian bottles are getting into their areas. It's full of plastic now. And so the clams have gone way down. Sorry to knock Evian. James.
I recycle my Evian bottles that the cat drinks. Yeah. I don't go all the way to Papua New Guinea to throw them away.
But it is a big problem now. It's really affecting them.
Mangroves are so great. And it's quite sad researching them because you read about all the threats to them, predominantly from climate change and habitat loss, habitat destruction, if people are using a strip of coastline for things like shrimp farming, which is a big industry in lots of these countries, then it just sort of they tear out the mangroves, basically. But they are incredible. They're among the only few plants which can tolerate salt water. Out of 400,000 species of plant in the world, 1,500 can tolerate saltwater, and mangroves are among them. They live for a really long time.
It's so alien when I hear it. Like, just all the things that they can do that other trees can't do. Mm. So, yeah, they filter out 90% of the salt that comes in. But the ones that don't do that, they've got these special leaves. Yeah. I mean, the leaves are like waxy substances where they leak out the salt.
They sweat out crystallized salt on their leaves. They're so cool.
But then there's other ones where they will basically send the salt to the old leaves and the old bark, so it's not touching the new bit of the tree. It's so nice. Intelligent. I'm using the word intelligent.
I'm using the word quite wrongly. It seems amazing. Like if you look around the world that lots of groups of women are in mangrove forests working, it seems.
Oh, really?
In Mexico, they have Las Chelameras, who are Mayan women who work in a certain area of mangroves, protecting the ecosystem. In Kenya, you have the mangrove mothers who work on Pate Island.
Island? Is that... You leave big footprints in Pate Island, don't you?
You know what? It might be Pate Island, but I prefer Pate Island, don't you? And in India, in Maharashtra, you have a collective of women who kind of work in the mangroves. They do safaris, but they also help protect the forest. Wow. So it just seems like everywhere you look around the world, wherever there's mangroves, there seems to be women working there.
We need to rename them. Sounds like they need a rebrand.
Yeah. They mop up tsunamis.
Incredible.
They absorb the energy of incoming waves when they're coastal.
So the wave can lose 2/3 of its energy, I read.
Yeah. That's really, really useful. There was a study in China which found they reduced floodwater level in a tropical storm by about 3 meters.
Wow.
Which is very useful.
Annoying if you're a surfer. Don't surf in a mangrove. You'll see a brilliant wave coming at you. It will have disappeared by the time.
Very few of the Beach Boys' big hits are about mangroves. But the other nice thing they do is they store huge amounts of carbon because they build up these big peat deposits beneath them. Mm-hmm. Some of them are up to 6 meters deep.
Wow. Yeah. And they did a study in 2001, so quite a while ago, but they found that the loss of mangroves is 35%, which is worse than tropical forests or coral reefs.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Don't like that fact at all.
Bad fact.
The world's biggest bacterium ever was found in a mangrove forest.
I think we mentioned this one.
Him.
Yeah.
I hope it was a her, otherwise that bacterium would have been arrested and forced to hand in polished rocks.
Can I say, if you eat mangrove... it contains asparagusic acid, which is the stuff that makes your urine smell.
Get away.
After eating asparagus.
Does it make your wee smell the same as asparagus does or different?
No,
like
the same. Yeah.
Wow.
So asparagusic acid also kills parasitic nematodes, which is why it's evolved into these two places. So it protects the asparagus plant and the mangroves against these nematode worms.
Oh, that's good.
Interesting thing about that.
They need wee mangroves.
Yeah.
They rely on fish wee. Ah. It turned out because they part of the way they survive is through consuming lots of nitrogen. They make great use of nitrogen, and that is produced by fish wee. And they did a study of a mangrove forest in the Bahamas, and they found that there were just two species of fish, two types of snapper, that doubled the amount of nitrogen in the water and made it possible to survive.
Wow. Hey, here's a little mini quiz.
Yeah. Right.
Which of these is not a nickname for mangroves?
Okay.
Walking trees, dead man's fingers, the kidneys of the coast.
Well, you would think kidneys of the coast because they effectively are doing what kidneys do, which is filtering stuff. So I'm going to say it's definitely not that.
That's not the nickname.
It's not the nickname.
That is the nickname.
It is.
Because your question is, which is not the nickname?
You're doing the long way around.
Double negative. Yeah. I'm going to say they look like they walk because their roots are so huge and they come out of the ground. I've actually always found them really creepy because they look like giant spiders, don't they? Fields of spiders.
A little bit,
so I think they're probably called walking trees. Is that what you said?
Well, I think that bananas are walking trees, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like bananas walk, as in they move.
Excuse me? Bananas are...
Banana trees.
Aside from in pajamas.
Banana trees. Banana trees will walk.
They move.
As
in they'll propagate another banana tree maybe a few meters away from them. And if you go back 2 years later, it looks like the tree's moved.
Oh. Yeah. I think this was like one of the famous moments on QI where Sean Locke said, the trees, they walk. And Stephen was like, no, they don't. And then it came through.
We were literally on the computers going, yes, they do, Stephen. Yes, they do, Stephen.
Stephen, this is Andy coming to you from my computer tower. I can confirm. I'm going to say that I think you kind of danced around the idea of the dead man fingers when you said spiders. It looks like dead man fingers are coming out with these big poles. So I say yes to that, and I think you're tricking us. I think all three are.
Dan's got it. They're all nicknames for mangroves. Walking trees.
You couldn't be asked to come up with a full fake nickname.
Dead man's fingers. The kidneys of the car. I'll come up with another one now.
Go on.
Stop staring at me, all three of you. I need time.
You can do it later and edit it in.
Yeah. Salty creepy boys.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a difficult one. Can I quickly talk about a place where women are not allowed?
Mm. Yeah.
The Yorkie Factory.
Early noughties reference for this, British listeners.
This is Mount Athos in Greece, which was known as the place of 6,000 beards. Because there were monasteries on there and monks were allowed, but women were not allowed in there. And they had a law called the Avaton, which prohibited women from entering. And the idea is that the monastery started when the Virgin Mary was sailing across the coast or something, and then stopped at this place, and the voice of God said, let no other woman come here, because the Virgin Mary's been here and no other women are allowed.
So we're going to put a stop to that.
We didn't like her. Yeah.
So even when the British royal family went, Prince Philip was allowed on the island, and the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II,
get away,
wasn't.
Wow.
Helena of Bulgaria, she, in the 14th century, had the plague, and she was brought there to try and help her, but she was carried so that her feet never touched the ground.
Loophole.
I know. And there was a brilliant writer, a French writer called Marie Choisy, and she had written a book called Un Mois chez les filles, which was A Month with the Girls, where she was in a brothel. And then she wrote a second book called Un Mois chez les hommes, which was A Month with the Men, which was about going to this place. And she had a double radial mastectomy.
Wow, that's commitment to the
task. I know.
What?
And wore a false mustache.
Wow.
And she posed as a man and went to this place. And she spoke to all the monks and stuff and asked them what was going on. And she asked one monk, she said, what's this deal? Like, is it true that you're not even allowed female animals in this place? And the monk said, we must draw the line somewhere. The day we possessed a hen, some brothers would argue that we should also accept a she-cat, a ewe, or even a she-ass. And there is but a short step from a she-ass to a woman.
What do you mean a ewe? Not a me? I'm not a woman. What are you talking about? Look at this moustache.
But yeah, isn't that amazing?
Wow.
I never heard of this Marie Choisy.
Wow. No, she Choisy'd pretty weirdly, I would say, having both your breasts lopped off.
Just to go on this journalistic expedition.
Yeah, she was like a feminist reporter and crazy sort of Louis Theroux of her time.
Yeah, but you won't see Louis chopping his dick off to get into this mangrove, will you? Like, that is...
I don't know, Louis, if you're listening.
I'm in a lady's mangrove in Papua. Hi, I'm Louise. I'm from the BBC. You okay? Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Andy.
My fact is that until the early 20th century, Swiss people were routinely being injured by the last ice age.
The film?
That's right. Hated it.
Just a squirrel with a nut. I don't know. I haven't seen it. is that what happens?
That's what it's about, yeah. Buries it's not under the ice. Can't find it. Very long.
Really?
Quest.
All four movies?
Yeah.
There's padding.
Hasn't found it yet.
Look, let's press on. This is... a fact. It came from a list of facts. Every year, there's a guy called Tom Whitwell who does a list of 52 things he learned.
Oh, yeah.
And I've mentioned one of his facts before.
Yeah, years ago.
I have to limit myself because it's such a great list of facts. But he mentioned this fact, which came from a brilliant London Review of Books article by Jonah Goodman, and it's all about Swiss people who, until the early 20th century, loads of them had goiters, right? And that is a bulge of flesh that comes out of the front of your neck. And they can be really big. They can really limit your life if you have one. They make you wheeze. They weigh on your windpipe. They're really unpleasant to have, you know. And they're harmful. And everyone in Switzerland had them. Not everyone, but a lot of people had them.
80% of the country.
It was
crazy.
And it was only on the sort of Swiss Alpine plateau. We're quite near Lake Geneva, actually, for this fact as well. And there were dozens of theories doing the rounds. Is it the landscape, the air, the high altitude sunlight? Is it the incest, someone said? is it moral failure? Incest, probably a category of that. Anyway, like all these theories were doing rounds. And basically, it turned out it was thanks to the last ice age, because during the last ice age, Switzerland, very high up, was covered by an ice sheet that was about 1,000 meters thick, and it melted and then refroze loads and loads of times, right? And it just absolutely ripped off the top 250 meters of rock and soil from the Swiss plateau. And wherever the ice sheet was, the soil was stripped of a chemical, which was iodine. And the lack of iodine is what causes goiters.
And everyone was like, thank God it wasn't the incest.
We can keep going, hon.
Oh, dear. And that was, and it was lack of iodine. And it just, yeah, it just did a complete number on half the population of Switzerland for centuries. It was a
extraordinary
curse.
I can't believe I've never heard of this. Had you guys heard of this before?
No.
It's astonishing, because this isn't like, you know, the 1700s. This is up until the 1920s.
Yeah.
That 30% of like military personnel in Switzerland had giant, like when we talk about fashion, as we're going to do in the next fact, you know, you do stuff to, yeah, I know.
Exciting.
We rarely throw forward.
Wow.
But like, you know, clothing was designed largely, you know, for them to hide these giant throbbing lumps on their necks.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, and you can see photos.
Can I do something a bit more classic and throw back to the last fact?
Yeah. Good. Yes. Better. Safe ground.
They used to have these things in the mangroves, in the biggest mangrove in the world, which is on the border of India and Bangladesh, I think. And they would also have these big sort of collars which covered your entire neck, but it wasn't to stop you from being able to see your goiter. Can you guess what it was for?
Vampires? Anti-vampire device?
Close.
Get away.
Ooh. Yeah, very close.
Think
of something more real.
Werewolf. No.
So not that close.
A spider. A spider.
No, it's because tigers live there. And people working in the mangroves, they would be caught by tigers. And
I don't know if a little rough around my head is going to make you feel that safe.
They were quite solid collars, but they would stop the tigers from being able to bite you.
Grab you by the scruff of the neck.
Yeah. Sorry,
wow.
Anyway, we were talking about goiters.
Goiters.
Yeah. And I find it incredible that the ice age was this specific, just affected this one place so specifically. Everywhere else was kind of okay, but it stripped away the iodine. I think maybe it was moral failing. Because that's just a very targeted approach.
No, it's good to relitigate these things and test the theory.
But it was quite hard for them to know exactly how many people had it, because everyone was hiding it. People were embarrassed by it. So the census, if they did any kind of surveying, wouldn't really truly show it. So when conscription was happening for the armies, you had to have your medical and there was no way of hiding it. So in 1921, nearly 30% of 19-year-old conscripts had a goiter on their neck. Yeah.
If you buy one of those Swiss Army knives, there is a special goiter implement. People always say it's for taking stones out of horseshoes, but actually it's for popping a goiter.
Yeah. Oh, God.
There was Mark Twain, when he visited in 1880, said...
I bet he had something typically kind and understanding to say about it.
Wow. Made your views on Twain clear?
I don't like him.
He said, this isn't going to endear you to him, actually. He wrote, I have seen the principal features of Swiss scenery, Mont Blanc and the goiter.
Lovely. Thank you, Mark. Another very human and wise observation. Sorry, I just don't like Mark Twain. Anyway, let's move on.
Wow.
It's because he was incredibly rude about Jane Austen once.
He said, my God.
He famously wrote, oh, I'd like to dig her up and beat her over the head with her own shinbone. And I just think, give me a break, Mark.
Yeah.
Next time you write something as good as Emma, you can have a pop at Big Dog Jane. But you never did. And you never will. Because you're dead. Anyway, sorry.
Okay.
So it affected not just goiters. So there was this other medical condition called, it was known at the time as cretinism, right? Where people had very serious developmental problems. They grew much shorter than normal. Their features didn't grow properly. A lot of them were deaf and mute. And there was a Swiss goiter commission. There were schools across the country for deaf mute children. As in, it really was a national health disaster.
That's what I mean. I can't believe we haven't heard of this.
Exactly.
The word cretin comes from the French Alps because of this.
Right.
And do you know the origin of the word cretin? I thought it was really interesting because obviously it became an extremely offensive word. But originally it came from an Alpine dialect word because it was so common in the Alps. It came from an Alpine dialect word for Christian. Cretin. And it was to remind people that these people who looked often, you know, so inhuman in a way, a lot of deformities, to remind people that they were still human Christian people who were equally loved by God, and we should be very kind to them.
I did not know that. That's amazing.
It started out as a very humane term.
Because Bertrand Russell, he thought that iodine might have been evidence that humans don't have a soul. Because what he saw was that when you gave this chemical to people, suddenly they became more human, as he saw it.
Right.
Perhaps it's all about chemistry and it's not about the soul and Christianity and whatever.
How interesting. Yeah, that kind of, you can see the kind of, we're chemical-driven machines when you throw something new into us and it changes the core. And it's kind of what happened, right? So when all the theories that we're talking about earlier, moral compasses and all that sort of stuff, bad beer, when the original list, and that was on there,
When you wake up in bed with a cousin or sorry, it's the bad beer that caused the incest.
There was four main players, I believe, when it comes down to how this eventually got solved. One was called Otto Bayard, and they were pushing this theory that, yeah, we need more iodine. And he actually went to sort of little communities and he upped the iodine in all the things that they were consuming. So he went to the cows and he made sure that it was in the salt that they were licking. It was in the, that, you know, in the milk that they were producing. There was tiny amounts that were being put into the food of this family. And he did it over a term of a school course in the winter, and he came back and they had gotten better. And suddenly he went, Jesus, this is what it is. They're missing their iodine.
And that's why we have it now, that people put iodine in salt, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because people around the world eat salt. Everyone eats a bit of salt. Yeah. Iodine actually works quite well with salt, so they put it in there, and that's kind of what did it.
This article, so this article, and that Andy said, says 88% of salt is now iodine salt.
Yeah, not the UK, weirdly.
Really?
No, we get our iodine otherwise. Okay. But I mean, it's in a lot of milk, because cows are given iodine, and so it sort of happens that way.
I had no idea our salt wasn't iodized. Really?
I believe the vast majority is not.
Rock salt usually isn't, is it?
Yeah, like sea salt and rock salt are not, because they're made differently. But even table salt in the UK is not standardly iodized. Yeah. The doctor who found it was called Heinrich Hunziker. Mm. Great name. And it's because it all goes through your thyroid gland, which is at the front of your neck. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get enough, it swells up because it's desperately trying to find more iodine from your bloodstream. So it swells and swells and swells.
Oh.
That's what causes it. And it's like all of it, the brain fog and the muscle ache and the goiters, all of it is due to your body just desperately hunting. But the problem that took them a long time to work out why it was just a little bit of iodine was required is that if you give people too much iodine, it leads to catastrophic health consequences in the other direction.
Yeah.
So you need 1/15,000th of 1 gram of iodine a day.
It's mad.
It's very small.
How
and
much?
So, and they were trying to give people a gram a day of iodine, and then they were getting terribly ill, and they were saying, well, the iodine's a disaster. Look at that.
Yeah.
So it took a long time.
It is one of those frustrating things. It's a little bit like hand washing, where people were saying it for over 100 years. People kept saying, do you know what? I think iodine's the answer to this. And everyone, no, don't. It's going to kill you. And one of the key people, another one of the key people who changed things was a guy called Hans Eggenberger.
Mm.
Sounds like a McDonald's offering. Was actually a very important man.
Do you want to? Well, someone said to him one day, "Do you want salt on your Eggenberger?" And he realised he had this moment.
Good old Eggenberger. He was a very charismatic guy. He was the mayor. He was in charge of a specific Swiss canton, and he realised that iodine, a little bit of iodine, was the answer. And so he decided to add to his town cinema. This is in the 1920s. His town cinema's programme of light entertainment. So the cinema was showing loads of really fun films. He added a lecture on iodized salt in amongst the light entertainment, but for some reason, because he was so charismatic and popular, everyone flooded in to watch it, and he put lots of jokes in. He did this lecture, lots of tricks and jokes and fun words, like he called it whole salt. I don't know, that's not fun, but you know, it was
pretty
funny at the time. Anyway, he straight after everyone went to see this great film of his, there was a petition. It got thousands of signatures, and iodized salt was introduced.
Brilliant.
Wow.
Yep. And then Gandhi hated it, didn't he?
Gandhi?
Did he?
Yeah.
What, the iodization of salt?
Yeah, he did lots of good stuff, of course, Gandhi, but...
we have to say, for balance.
The problem was that it was the British who were taxing local salt and then kind of replacing it with these iodized salt. And he kind of started anti-salt riots.
Yes, did he walk to the sea protesting about the salt?
He did
thing?
A long walk, yeah.
To try and get proper just salt from the sea?
I think it was raising awareness, obviously.
I mean, obviously, like, the tax thing was real, but the iodized thing was kind of just a side hustle that he thought was colonial.
I see. Yeah. A rare misfire from Gandhi there.
I'm not trying to cancel Gandhi like you're trying to cancel Mark Twain, just to say.
No, and I'll cheerfully keep going on the Twain thing. Goitre used to be nicknamed Derbyshire Neck.
Okay.
In the UK.
In the UK, right.
Yeah.
Supposedly because...
People in Buxton got it, maybe.
Oh, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lots of bits of Derbyshire are quite far from the sea, and seafood contains
all of
lots.
It, in fact.
Well, some bits, some bits are closer than others. Yeah.
You're right. The exact centre of Derbyshire is a long way from the sea. Yeah,
like and the seafood contains lots of iodine, so maybe people living in the less sea adjacent bits of Derbyshire, which obviously doesn't touch the sea, we're getting a bit less.
Just on iodine, it's very useful in other ways. I actually remember, this is just personal, but I remember having to drink iodine water. Have you guys ever drunk that? Because it purifies water.
No.
I went to Malawi when I was a teenager for like 2 months. And yeah.
With iodine tablets.
Yeah, you drop an iodine tab in and you taste it for the first time and you go, I can't drink this shit for 2 months.
So what does it do?
It purifies water.
It just purifies.
Yeah, it's very useful.
I feel like I've had that. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's why Andy's the only one with a goiter around the table.
I really thought my polo neck was concealing that, but apparently
not. It did save you of that tiger, in fact, too, though, didn't it?
But something else it does, you can detect counterfeit money. And if you remember your school chemistry, you might be able to work out why. So real money is on cotton or linen, usually paper. Uh-huh. So we shouldn't call it paper money. Counterfeit money, often just made of actual paper, wood-based paper. Right. And wood-based paper contains starch. And do you remember when you're detecting starch in science, iodine is the thing that reacts to starch and shows up if starch is in something. So if you rub an iodine pen on paper and it reacts to it, then it means that it's made of wood. But this has been used to catch people. And there was a story in 2016 where a 14-year-old girl caused the police to descend on her school lunch, and she was put in handcuffs she paid with a $2 bill, bizarrely, that an iodine pen that the school had showed up as fake.
The police came.
She was put in handcuffs. She wasn't allowed to eat lunch that day. She went hungry. They tricked. She said, "I promise that my grandma gave me the money."
Was her grandmother doing the forging?
It turns out her grandmother's not a criminal either. This method doesn't work on money that was made before about 1955, and her grandma had given her obviously a note that had been sitting in her wallet for a very long time. So she went free in the end. She is not still incarcerated.
She was still incarcerated.
But you got to keep her in just in case.
Pardoned by Biden 50 years later.
Yeah, her and the turkey.
Gosh, I've got an audience fact about ice sheets.
Oh yeah.
It's from Percy Fulford. And I just love the way this email begins, right? Percy writes, "Admittedly, this one sounds a bit like a James Harkin quotes fact, but bear with me." Oh, I think Percy has confused James and Dan here.
As fuck in... off, Percy.
Thank you, Percy, for your email.
Does he put his address on?
I'm not giving you it. I'm sure he just means a Dan Schreiber fact. Well, I'm glad no one's worried that I'm taking offense from that. because Dan likes his crypto stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Anyway. Well, Percy,
are you going to tell us?
I've got to
say,
this fact is falling on very stony ground. In the last ice age, much of Canada was covered in massive, several kilometre thick glaciers, which have now melted. Those glaciers were immensely heavy, but now the weight has been lifted. The crust is springing back up at about 12 millimetres a year, like a memory foam mattress.
Yeah. Hmm.
However, until the crust...
12 million metres a year?
Millimetres. Millimetres. It's amazing that picture of Earth from space, isn't it, where Canada is...
People are just
hundreds of miles.
I'm underwhelmed.
However, until the crust fully rebounds from the weight of these glaciers, Canada's landscape is missing the immense mass that caused its shape. So for the time being, moving to Canada, particularly to somewhere near Hudson Bay, remains an effective weight loss method.
Good to know. If that's true of the UK as well, I should say. Yeah, we had an ice sheet that went as far down as pretty much where Stonehenge is, and then it's not there anymore. And that's why... It's the UK is slightly slanted, and that's why you get big cliffs where Dover is. But if you go to Morecambe, for instance, it's a really long, sandy beach.
It's just been crushed down.
Yeah.
Right.
And now it's bouncing back, right?
Over millions of years, it will do, yeah.
You can't bouncy castle on it, but...
I should say, this is from memory, but there's another thing about ice sheets you just reminded me of, which is there's a restaurant that was in Italy... And I think due to climate change, it was on a glacier, and the glacier is very, very slowly moving, but moving more than you thought. And they now think that the restaurant might be in Switzerland because it was quite near the border and it's kind of slowly moved in that direction.
That's amazing.
Wow.
We should say as well, I stupidly didn't write this bit down, but one of the big moments in this whole story of this main fact about the last Ice Age being responsible is there was one person who stood up in front of the academic community and said, I think it's the melting ice sheets. I think that's what's done it. Yeah. Like, it was a proper, he put it forward as the idea, and everyone just went, you are nuts. Yeah. That's worse than the incest idea. That's like,
who was it? Hans McMuffin.
Yeah. Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that during the reign of Charles II, women's dressing tables tended to include both face and nipple makeup.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're making up your face,
yeah,
I'm no expert, but you're putting on foundation and you're putting on stuff on top of that.
Yeah.
Maybe some lipstick.
Do they call it nipstick?
Nice.
They should have had.
How are you making up the nipple, basically?
Yeah, is it more of a lipstick or a foundation? I think that's a great question.
Yeah, it feels like it'd be a foundation.
Yeah, more like a foundation.
I do it as eyeliner. Paint some little eyelashes around it. So you're kind of winking with your nip. That's
so quite... it looks like a little sunshine.
Yeah, nice.
I do lipstick. Make it a big red blob.
Wow.
Yeah.
But why did they need it?
Well, they needed it because this came in a period where Charles II basically lowered the cleavage line. He was
sorry. Can King Charles do that now that he's the king?
That's why he picked the name Charles. He's going to start where he left off. He's been easing us all in gently, but he will gently start lowering those lines.
The environment thing is just to lure us in, isn't it? And then he whips away our tops.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he was a sort of like, you know, he came in, he was very liberal.
He was the Merry Monarch, was he?
Yeah. Merry Monarch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
his
nickname.
That was his nickname.
He was very libidinous, saucy, pro-theatre.
Just after the Cromwellian times.
Exactly.
Literally anyone would have seen Merry after all the Cromwell. Yeah. Not a high bar, but he genuinely did seem like a bit of a goer.
Yeah,
a
and they just grew this trend whereby if you were wearing corsets and your nipple happened to peek over, that was not a bad thing. And then suddenly everyone thought, well, let's lower the corset a bit. Let's get the boobs out. And it was, you know, seeing an ankle was far more scandalous and titillating to a pervert than seeing
to anybody. You didn't have to be a pervert.
The word used to be ankylating, didn't it?
Ooh,
yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, it was still very raunchy. We should say it wasn't like people were going around the shop flashing a boob to get a free loaf of bread. It was still, you know, there are paintings we have of people exposing breasts, but they were generally prostitutes or actresses.
Same thing.
Who were meant to
in
be
those
a bit,
days.
Indeed.
Good caveat. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a famous Nell Gwynn picture.
This is why I was never allowed to host the Oscars a second time.
She was amazing, by the way. Just before we disappear on Nell Gwynn, I've never read about Nell Gwynn before.
Oh, yeah.
And so Charles II basically stipulated that when you're at the theatre and men who were in all the plays playing women, that should no longer be the case. It should be women now playing women. There was Margaret Hughes, who was the first woman to step on stage and play a woman in a play. And then Nell Gwynn, who became very famous. They met. She was working in...
Her and Charles met.
So basically, she was working outside a theatre, which was the King's Theatre. And then she met this guy who was called Charles Hart, who became known as Charles I to her.
Not to be confused with the headless one.
Yes, very clever. Yeah. Oh, that was just what she nicknamed him.
It's what she nicknamed him.
Retroactively after she got together with Charles II.
Well, because then she had a Charles II, which was Charles Sackville. So actually Charles II was her Charles III.
This is a sort of bawdy farce developing. They're all behind a different door, all on stage. Yeah.
She was, what I know about Mel Gwynn is her mother was a prostitute. Mm-hmm. She was an orange seller, I think.
Yep, that's right.
And then became an actor/prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
I always think it's very Pygmalion. Isn't it? Don't you think?
It's a much
sexier Pygmalion.
Because
she very much came from nowhere, didn't she?
Yeah, a
sexy Pygmalion.
She was very witty. There's all these anecdotes that have made it through the years. So like the one time she was going in a carriage through the streets of a city and the people were furious because they thought that she was a different mistress. They thought that she was the Duchess of Portsmouth. And so they were yelling at her going, "You Catholic whore, you Catholic whore." And she leaned out of the carriage and she said, "Pray, good people, be civil. I am the Protestant whore." Not the Catholic.
That's clever.
It's, you know, really witty.
Rolled
at the time.
Around laughing at the time.
Yeah.
Yes. But anyway, so she was one of the people who got their waps out. Waps.
And we still have paintings of it from the time.
We do. And yeah. It was a time, it was kind of like the Roaring Twenties, wasn't it? Because it was post, just for international listeners, it was just after we'd had this like unpleasant interregnum, uptight,
following an already following an unpleasant civil war.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone was a bit tired of the unpleasantness. They weren't allowed to have fun. The Puritans were all over them. And then this period came in and everyone loosened right up and people got really into fashion and makeup. So women hadn't worn that much makeup. They'd worn very thick lead paint on their faces, often as famously Queen Elizabeth did and may have killed her, but other than that didn't really wear that much until now. And it was the century of the massive hooped skirt, when you see women in these giant skirts they couldn't fit through doors. That was then, and I didn't realize with the hooped skirts people took the piss out of them the moment they appeared, and men kind of hated them. Men just laughed at women for wearing them. And
you couldn't see the ankles, could you? Mm-hmm. If you're a pervert.
Yeah, they're very upset about that. But yeah, women stuck to them. And actually, they were, when you look at like how they were made, you had much more motion in them. Right. Because basically, they involved this big whalebone kind of giant umbrella sticking out from your waist. But underneath, you were just fully naked and free. So it used to be that you'd be covered in heavy petticoats all over your legs and stuff.
You could be doing river dance under there.
You
no
could
one
be doing
knows.
Anything. Yeah. You could be smuggling houses under there. Mm. But they were quite sexy, because if you bent over, you did expose a bit of ankle.
Oh, right.
Really? So, if you really bent over, you could expose everything.
You could,
I think even perverts would probably think that was a bit much.
The waistcoat was invented by Charles II. On the 14th of October, 1666, which is, isn't that amazing that we know when the idea of wearing a suit and a waistcoat is on that exact date?
Wow. Did he think of it, or did someone help him?
His tailor invented his name.
You know what? I mean, he got the credit, fairness, but there will have been other people who did a lot of the hard yards. But there was accusations that England was being dictated to by France in lots of different ways. And they were saying that basically, not only that, everyone in court is just copying French clothes. And Charles II was not very happy about this and wanted to make a statement and said, okay, we're going to invent a new thing. We're going to all wear trousers, all wear jackets, all wear waistcoats, and they're going to be made by English wool. And you're not allowed to wear your French fashion anymore. You have to wear the English fashion. And we know about it because Pepys writes about it. Oh. So it definitely did happen.
What year was that? Sorry.
1666, just after the fire.
When, again, you'd think like a king with his head, you're like, a king with his head screwed on, sorry, Charles II, that's probably a bit insensitive, would have his mind on other matters, you like recovering from the plague of the fire, then...
You need distractions,
the waistcoat.
Political distractions.
Yeah, it's true.
Pepys wrote that the king banned pinking and the waistcoats because he said that it made his people in his court look like magpies.
Pinking.
What's pinking?
Pinking is where you get some cloth and you make like tiny holes in it to make a pattern.
Oh yeah,
and it's very fashionable at the time, but right. The king banned it.
It's probably bad for your insulation as well.
Having small holes
all over your clothes, it probably doesn't do your you know,
well. Weirdly, if you wear like a string vest, that's just holes. That's but actually, it's supposed to be very warm because it traps the air.
I mean, just if it was just holes, it would be nothing, wouldn't it? That's Emperor's new string vest. It's, but it's mostly holes.
It's definitely mostly holes. No, I get that. I've never worn a string vest.
You would amaze me.
I can't believe it, Andy. No. I can only imagine you on your Christmas holidays going down to Margate Beach with a handkerchief around your head.
I go home, I climb up into the computer tower. I take my clothes and get my string vest on.
Weirdly, even though women were uncovering their boobies, they were covering their faces at this time. And this went in and out of fashion throughout the 1600s and 1700s. Masks that cover your whole face, and they'd often have a little bead sewn into them where your mouth was, so the way you held them on was by keeping this bead before your teeth. You bit them on.
Wow.
Which added apparently an extra air of mystery, because you couldn't speak, so you were a mute.
You could go, hello.
That was a very sexy way of speaking in those days.
Hiya.
Hello.
Isn't that weird? They were called vizards.
Was it to stop the sunshine from, like, because I've
good guess.
Seen that in modern day, sometimes people would wear like balaclavas, wouldn't
stops
they?
Stops the Great Plague, which was probably knocking about a bit.
Are many people wearing balaclavas? Are you sure you haven't been robbed a number of times? He's gone, he's just trying to avoid getting burned.
I think you see it in some countries, they'll wear like colourful balaclavas.
I think more veils than balaclavas. I think
I'm thinking like, you know, like Pussy Riot wore those things.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've seen them. I might be wrong.
Well, it was for sun protection a lot of the time and initially, but then it became a fashion which was unrelated to sun protection, and it was to have this air of virtue, or high quality, high breeding.
But would you have your boobs out at the same time?
Oh, yeah, naked from the neck down.
Oh, really? But you're unrecognisable. No. Well, no, but you might do, you know, because most people are recognisable by their faces and not by their boobs.
So. Yeah, and you're not going to admit to being the man who recognises the woman just by her boobs, are you?
No.
Not when you've gone to the theatre with your wife. Well, that's Sally over there.
What is that story? I'm going to really butcher it. Can you tell it, Andy? It's really good. It's in Oxford.
It's a men-only area in Oxford. Yeah. It's a bit of the river, a swimming area called Parsons Pleasure, I think, where only male dons or maybe undergraduates would swim, but they would swim naked. Mm-hmm. And one day there were three dons there and some ladies happened by. They were, you know, they were surprised, and the dons are all naked. Mm-hmm. And they're all very embarrassed, and quickly, you know, two of the dons grab their, I don't know, flannel or whatever, and cover their genitals. And the third don very calmly doesn't cover his genitals. He covers his face. Mm. And nice. And they say, what have you done that for, Charles? If his name was Charles. And he says, well, I'm not recognisable by my genitals. So.
But unfortunately, they all heard of being called Charles. Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found on our social media accounts. I'm on @Insta...
How right. did you get that?
Yeah,
that's
right, Grandad. Oh, God.
I'm on HTTP. I'm on Instagram on @Schreiberland. Andy?
I'm @AndrewHunterM on various...
James?
I'm on LinkedIn if you want to offer me a job.
And yeah, if you want to get to us as a group, Anna, where do they go?
You can email podcast@qi.com or you can tweet @nosuchthing.
That's right. Or go to our website, nosuchthingasafish.com, because if you do, you're going to find all the previous episodes up there, as well as the gateway link into Club Fish, which is a very fun place where a lot of the listeners of our show get together, get bonus material, and also get to chat to each other on a thing called Discord. Find out about it there. Otherwise, just come back next week and we'll be back with another episode then. We'll see you then. Goodbye.